From Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall, and we're talking about banned books this week on Newsmakers. Later on, we'll talk to Sam Sinta, who's a publisher of Fulcrum Publishing and a lecturer at Viterbo and UWL. Also, Beth Hartung will join us. She's the owner of Pearl Street Books. It'll be exciting to welcome her back to Newsmakers again. But joining us now is a familiar voice to our show, and one less so. Barry McKnight is here. He's the Access and Engagement Manager at the La Crosse Public Library. Barry, welcome back to Newsmakers.
Well, glad to be here. Thank you very much.
Also joining us today, Abby Von Arks, who is the Library Media Specialist. She works at Central High School in the La Crosse School District. Abby, thanks a lot for being here.
Thanks for having me, Ezra.
So let's start with just setting the stage with getting some of our terms defined. We talk about banned books, and in a society where like publishers really can publish pretty much anything, and stores can sell what they want. What are we talking about, Barry, when we talk about banned books?
Well, you know, Banned Books Week, which is from the American Library Association, I think it's in its 40-something year. It's about banned and challenged books. So the banned part of it would be removing those materials, whether they're books or something else, from a public collection. That would either be in a library or public library, a school library, very rarely in an academic library. But it's also about the challenges. So people requesting that a book be banned, and how that works. And that's far higher numbers than the books that actually do get banned.
Yeah, I think I saw something from the ALA that said in the latest year that data is available, which is 2022, like more than 1,200 demands came across the country asking for books to be censored from libraries. Abby, is that something that's like one of the largest numbers ever in recent years as a librarian? Have you noticed more demands or more questions about why libraries carry certain things?
I personally have not ever had to discuss a challenge or a ban. I know some of my colleagues at the La Crosse Public Library have heard or discussed books with either, you know, parents, grandparents, patrons. With the school district, we actually have, and I know Barry as well at the La Crosse Public Library, we have a pretty formal reconsideration policy. If somebody were interested in discussing a book or why it's on the shelf, I just actually recently, each year, the librarians at each building have to update our reconsideration committee. So it's not just the librarian or the building admin who is looking at a book if a challenge is brought. It's a really wide swath of people within the district and the community actually as well. So I personally have not recently had to discuss a book with a patron, but my colleagues I know have.
And you work in the school district, which is a somewhat different environment than the public library, which is more of an all ages place and has something for everybody. In the school, you're obviously gearing that library toward whatever, like whether it's in the elementary school, or there's obviously different material in kindergarten versus high school or something like that. But you have experience working in a variety of library situations. Is that reconsideration process, has that been different in the public school versus at a regular public library?
I feel like it's very similar in terms of, you know, if somebody has an issue with a book, there's usually a standard form. And the forms tend to be similar across libraries. You know, you're asking what the individual finds objectionable, excuse me, to the book. Often you ask if they've read the book or not, if they've read it in its entirety. Just kind of, it's information gathering at that point. And then once a formal reconsideration form is turned in, that's when it, you know, you get more people involved. So mm-hmm. In the case of a public library. Usually that's the library director, the library board, librarians in that specific department. So if it's children's versus teen versus adult. So there are a lot of similarities too. And I think we kind of look, especially at the in the school libraries, we in La Crosse at least, we have a very strong collaborative relationship with the public library, and we I think work together closely in that way. So yeah.
Barry, how often do people raise concerns about material at the library?
Well, that how often they file a formal reconsideration request is not as much compared to people voicing their concerns. So what I mean by that is I've had a number of discussions with patrons, maybe about books or about certain materials or about the sort of the process or that kind of thing. Most don't carry them forward because, for one, it does require that person to view that material in its entirety. So you can't just be, I don't like the cover of this book. I don't like the title. I don't know what this is. I'm just going to ban it. I just want it to be banned or removed. It has to be an articulated reason why, and that's through reviewing that material. So, for most people, that sort of is enough to kind of deter them. But really, the part of it is sort of explaining how materials are selected and why, sometimes the questions I've gotten have been, why don't we have a certain book on the shelf? And was that a kind of political bias on our part or something along those
Okay, so
lines?
are you like rather than you have this, I don't want it, you often hear from people who are like, I'd like to see this, and you're censoring my point of view by not carrying this literature.
Right. So then you have to have a conversation with them about, well, we have, limited space on our shelves, and we look at circulation reports to see how many times titles have circulated in X number of years. And a lot of books get published. We can't have every book on the shelf,
So you talked about people like less formally coming up and are these like people who are generally interested in finding out answers, or do they just want to be heard and want to let you know what they think about you and your books?
I think it's both. But what's also, I think, increased over the last number of years, certainly in the time that I've been in libraries, is the tactic of harassment. So organizations, political organizations, political groups, they'll look at, say, a library, they'll review its policies, and they'll search for weak points. So, for example, they may try to flood you with requests to remove a book, or they may, something along those lines. So a lot of libraries have had to revamp their policies to, prevent a death by a thousand cuts kind of a situation.
Interesting. So, Abby, when you're looking at the contents of a school library, how do you decide what books need to go at what I don't know, grade level or what educational level? What should be included or excluded? Because I would imagine not only is your space limited, as Barry pointed out with the public library, but also your teachers are going to expect you to have certain material for teaching their classes, and that material is going to get used if it's geared toward the actual age group that your library serves.
Yeah, so a school library is very different than a public institution in that, as you said, we serve specific grade levels. So not only are we looking at works that are written and appropriate both content-wise but also reading level for those grade levels, but we also have to work closely with our curricular areas. So what do teachers need? How can we support them in their classroom in terms of the materials we have on the shelf? What research are students at my level at least, and in the middle and the elementary level, what research are students doing? And so that really dictates the collection specifically in terms of like nonfiction resources, but also for fiction resources too. You know, one of Central's kind of overarching building goals the last couple of years is, you know, literacy and a culture of reading. And so with that in mind, and the librarian I took over for, phenomenal librarian, she retired, super strong collection. I am also going to purchase books that encourage students to check them out and read them, because we want to promote that culture of leisure reading as well, beyond just their academics. And so for, and really for all librarians, we obviously cannot read cover to cover every item we add to our collection. We rely heavily on, you know, our colleagues, but also professional journals, in which books are reviewed and recommended. You know, for me, I rely heavily on School Library Journal, which does book reviews by age and grade level. At the high school level too, I have to consider, you know, because we have 18-year-olds in our classrooms, I have to consider adult material as well, potentially to purchase, but also materials that may more often be found in a middle school or elementary library, depending on, you know, just reading level and engagement too, and how these items are going to be used in the classroom or in support of classroom teachers. So actually a lot goes into collection development. And then, as Barry mentioned too, you have to look at the data. So circulation data, if something, and you know, sometimes this just hurts my librarian heart, because you read a book and you love it and you think it's amazing, but if there aren't readers for that book in your space, if it's not moving off the shelf, eventually it's something that you might have to potentially weed to make room for a new item as well. So a lot goes into it.
Mm-hmm. What kind of when people are challenging books, I talked about the 1,200 demands over 2022 across the country. What kinds of books are people challenging in 2023?
The ALA, the American Library Association, both Barry and my professional association, they do keep really good data in terms of both challenges and bans. And most recently, you know, this can change from year to year. I believe, and Barry, you can correct me if I'm wrong, I think they've been keeping data since like 2000 or 2001, mm-hmm. in terms of like the most banned or challenged books. They have lists. They keep track of, you know, where the challenges are being brought, whether it's, you know, school, library, public, academic. And really what we're seeing in the last couple of years, especially those books that are being the most frequently challenged, are those written or about people of color, and also members of the LGBTQIA+ community. Not that those are the only books that are being challenged, but the large portion of those share that characteristic.
Barry, is that something that has been a trend, or is that it? I mean, is that increasing in more recent years?
I'd say it's been very much the case over the last 10 plus years in libraries, that really those are the majority of the titles. You know, you look back at historically, books are often challenged for, you know, reasons of, you know, depictions of sex in it or something like that. But really, I think what we've seen in the last 15, 20 years has been really a push against the type of titles that Abby had mentioned. It's almost exclusively the case.
In a school library setting, I could imagine a lot of, well, you read about parents going to school boards even and petitioning for certain kinds of books to get removed or certain kinds of subject matter to be taught or not taught. And one of the themes that comes up a lot in news coverage is parents being upset about books related to gender or sexuality. In those particular subject matters, what goes into the thought process of what gets included in a school library or not, Abby?
So, and when you mentioned that to Ezra, like going before the school board, books being considered to be taught in classrooms, like in English classrooms, mm-hmm. that process is very different than collection development in a library, right? Because if you have a book that's going to be taught, you know, across the sophomore grade level or the freshman grade level, that process of adding an item or removing an item from curriculum is much more in depth. And I can't really speak to that.
Sure. Yeah.
I'm not
yeah.
part of the English faculty. But in terms of, you know, gender and sexuality and books on our shelf, and also books written by and about people of color, my biggest thing is that kids especially, but adults as well, need to see themselves and their stories reflected in the things that they read. And so there are students, I assume, you know, not just in La Crosse, who are dealing with issues of gender identity and sexuality. And so to remove those books that they can relate to, that reflect their own struggles or their own stories, I think is detrimental to them. I think it's very powerful. Representation is very powerful. And I think that's what librarians aim to do as well in building their collection, is that we want a representative collection of the community we serve, and especially in a school library, the students we serve and the faculty. So that comes into consideration as well. I want my students to see themselves reflected, you know, not in every book, because not every book is for every reader, but they should be able to see themselves in some of the stories on the shelves.
Abby just said not every book is for every reader, and that dovetails nicely into a question I was going to ask you, Barry, because there, as I wander through the La Crosse Public Library or any other library or bookstore or anything, I see any number of things that I'm just plain not interested in, but I also see things that are objectionable based on my particular worldview for one reason or another, and yet I think it's important that a wide variety of information be available to all kinds of people.
Absolutely.
So why is it for somebody who might not quite be there yet? Why is it important that libraries include not just things that everybody considers safe, but things that that are engaging ideas and points of view that some people or even many people might find objectionable?
Yeah, I mean, one of the reasons is because, you know, I think especially in today's media climate, these titles have to be available for folks, either as, because Abby mentioned, for representation purposes, or just in what used to be called, you know, the marketplace of ideas. And I think the ability to have access to information that you may not agree with, but you're still going to objectively look at or apply critical thinking to, it's vitally important to the health of our society. And I think as far as the issue of banned and challenged books go, I think almost invariably from the very beginning, as they began to track these in this country, the impulse to ban or challenge books has been to further political agendas. So limit what people have access to, whether that's critical information. You know, it's, people seem to think that, I think some people seem to think that if you, by even debating an issue or reading an opposing viewpoint, that that's somehow going to threaten or corrupt yourself or your children. It's just absurd. I don't think that it, I wasn't certainly raised that way. I think having access to this kind of information is vitally important, as I said, to our republic, but it's also to our rights.
We're talking with Barry McKnight from the La Crosse Public Library and Abby Von Arx from the La Crosse School District. She works at Central High School, and we're talking about banned books and more broadly, we're talking about the availability of a wide variety of printed literature for people across all walks of life. And we're talking about it because it's Banned Books Week here on Newsmakers. We're going to continue our conversation in just a moment. If you'd like to reach out to the show, you can email me. Our email address is newsmakers@wpr.org. That's newsmakers@wpr.org. And our conversation continues in just a moment here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Ezra Wall with Abby Von Arx and Barry McKnight. Later, we're going to be joined by Sam Sinta and Beth Hartung, and we'll talk about that in just a moment. We've been talking about banned books, and I want to plug some of them now. I'm interested to know what you guys have read, whether it's like a classic banned book that's like been on the list for years and years and is now maybe more accepted and maybe a little bit cool because it used to be a banned book, or whether it's something that's more recently been challenged. Barry, do you want to get us started? What's a favorite banned book that you read?
Sure. Well, the one I've read most recently and one that I actually read aloud from last night at a library program we have called Storytime for Adults was Fahrenheit 451 by Ray Bradbury. So he wrote that in 1953 as a response to, in part, the second Red Scare and McCarthyism, but also as a reaction to Nazi book burnings. And in that book, you know, there's a dystopian society that now seems very, very familiar. So people were discouraged from reading. In fact, books were burned. Everyone was encouraged instead to stay in their homes and watch stories on flat screens on their walls, have transmitters in their ears, earbuds, to hear certain lines of political thought. And the idea of burning books was that these different voices weren't helpful or were disruptive. Even the fact that they existed was the case. So that book has been challenged quite a bit. It's a quite old book, obviously. It's a classic, but it's been objected to from everything from the depiction of firemen, which in the case of Fahrenheit 451, the purpose of firemen is to burn books, or to, you know, issues that it espoused a political agenda or threatened a traditional way of life.
All right, Abby, what about you?
Can I share too, Ezra?
Oh, yes.
Because I've been a children's librarian and now most recently I'm working with high school. My first is Looking for Alaska by John Green. It was one of the early recipients of the Prince Medal, which is given every year by the American Library Association, the subgroup, the Young Adult Library Services Association, for the best young adult novel published that year. I think many people probably know John Green now. Him and his brother Hank Green are very well-known YouTubers, and they do a lot on social media. But John is one of those voices who writes explicitly for teens and writes really authentic teenage characters, and was really on the forefront, I think, of like young adult genre. And Looking for Alaska is about a young boy who goes away to a boarding school, falls in love with a girl, and is really coming to grips with, you know, growing up and some of the hard choices that you make as a teenager, like on the cusp of adulthood, both in romantic relationships and non-romantic relationships. And so it's a book that is beautifully written, I think, doesn't write down to its teenage readers, is very authentic. And it's also one of the first books I had to read in my grad school coursework years and years ago when I was becoming a librarian. So it kind of has a nice place in my heart. And the other one because we've seen more recently, and I think Barry can speak to this as well, more objections to picture books that are being published for children. And a recently published picture book called Julian is a Mermaid by Jessica Love is a beautifully illustrated picture book. The text is very sparse, but it's about a young boy who always goes to the pool, goes swimming with his abuela, and sees these other women swimming, and he wants to be a mermaid. And so it's not told so much with text, but more with illustrations and him kind of finding himself. And when his abuela happens upon him, she's supportive of the way in which he sees himself. So I also would recommend that one too. Just, I mean, if anything, just for the illustrations because they're gorgeous.
Well, I'm going to mention one because it gives me a chance to pub all the apps that are available from the library, which is my favorite thing to do. I downloaded the Libby app,
Oh, yeah.
which I have access to because of, I'm a member of the library, and one of the books that I listened to on the Libby app while I was driving back and forth to some meetings in Green Bay, was Between the World and Me by Ta-Nehisi Coates, and it's interesting to see, like, in the last couple of years, all this public discourse, the term correctly or incorrectly applied that people use is critical race theory, and how people how black stories are taught in our schools. And that author, Ta-Nehisi Coates, has had to defend himself on several occasions when his books were noticeably removed from public education programs. So I thought it'd be interesting to listen to, and in fact it was, and I got to do that by using the Libby app. That you can get if you're a member of the library. Hoopla, Libby, Canopy, whole bunch of stuff. I mean, I like going to the library too, Barry, but I'm a busy guy.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we do have a lot of different ways to access those. And Abby had mentioned some of the some graphic novels. We also have an app called Hoopla, which while has books in it, has quite a few graphic novels and comics. So if you are not able to get in a library or if you don't have access to those, you can get digital access. So yeah, it's very popular.
We've got just a couple minutes left. I want to ask each of you if people are maybe they're readers anyway, but they haven't really thought of it in terms of banned books or contested books or controversial books. Is it specifically important that, like, when something becomes controversial in the public, is it important for people to seek out that specific material and engage in it, Barry?
I think so, certainly. I mean, even if that's not the book doesn't depict something that's your own lived experience, I think very much so. I think it broadens our horizons. Even like we had mentioned earlier about things that may not you don't share, say the political views or worldviews. It's important to practice critical thinking on what we believe. And I think censorship and the book banning and challenging is really for people who are is really advocated by people who are, in the end, unable to defend their views to themselves and are fearful of anything that might push back against that. So, yeah, I think critical thinking used to be something that was, really focused on in our society. It's not really anymore. Yeah, so I think that's maybe the vitally important.
Abby, your thoughts on intentionally engaging with things that are controversial?
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely agree with Barry. I think too often now with our very misinformation, disinformation, social media society, I think it's really easy to, as you mentioned earlier, Ezra, like see snippets of school board meetings or see snippets of a book or an item that taken out of context might seem quite objectionable, but thinking about the work as a whole, I think is really important. And taking that work in as a whole, not only to perhaps expose yourself to a lived experience that is very different from your own, but as Barry said, to maybe critically assess like why this would be offensive to you or to somebody else. And I think too, kind of touching on what Barry said, both Barry and I are parents, and thinking about, because there's a lot of talk about, protecting children and, what is good for kids. Sometimes I'm curious if people choose to single out books that may, if their child were exposed to that book, start some uncomfortable conversations as parents. And I think like that, maybe you don't feel comfortable having a conversation with your kid about a certain topic, but I think it can be very powerful in terms of not only your child's learning, but your own. So, yeah, I think engaging with them is an excellent choice.
Abby Von Arx is a library media specialist who works at Central High School. She's with the La Crosse Public School District. Barry McKnight is Access and Engagement Manager at the La Crosse Public Library. Thank you both very much for joining our conversation today during Banned Books Week.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Thank you, Ezra. Thanks, Barry.
Coming up in a moment, we're going to be talking to Sam Sinta, who's the publisher of Fulcrum Publishing and an instructor at Viterbo University and the University of Wisconsin La Crosse. Beth Hartung is the owner of Pearl Street Books. She'll be with us as well, and they're going to talk to us, among other things, about a really interesting event that they've got going on this weekend that you can participate in. If you would like to hear our program again, you can find this and all of our other conversations online. It's WPR.org/newsmakers. WPR.org/newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for listening to our conversation about Banned Books Week. Earlier, we talked to Barry McKnight from the La Crosse Public Library and Abby Von Arx from Central High School in La Crosse. And if you missed that conversation, you can check it out online. It's WPR.org/newsmakers. Now we turn our attention to the other areas of print. We've got Beth Hartung here. She's the owner of Pearl Street Books. We've talked to Beth before, and it'll be interesting to hear her perspective on how important it is that people have access to all kinds of books. And joining us as well is Sam Sinta. He's the publisher of Fulcrum Publishing. He's also a lecturer at UW-La Crosse and Viterbo University, and both of them have been on the show before. So I'll just say, everybody, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me. Good morning.
Yes, thank you, Ezra, as always. Great to be here.
We're talking about Banned Books Week. Sam, talk about it from the publisher's perspective. You can obviously publish whatever you'd like to publish, and so it's not like somebody can come in your office and say, oh, you're banned from publishing this. What do you think of as a publisher, as a free speech advocate in that realm when you think of Banned Books Week?
Well, you certainly have a responsibility and an allowance, obviously, under the First Amendment. So I like to think that the First Amendment, freedom of speech and freedom of press extend to book publishers as well. But as my friend Rusty Cunningham, former publisher of the La Crosse Tribune, always likes to point out, being publisher also means you have a responsibility. So it means that we're not going to publish things that are libelous. We're not going to publish things that don't have a foundation in fact. But at the same time, we should be able to publish with a free, open area of opinion, because part of our role is to get conversations going. In fact, the phrase for the word fulcrum, we chose that very intentionally when we started almost 40 years ago, as both a balance point, but also as the point where motion begins. And this whole idea that we see ourselves as a place that sparks conversations, that we are dedicated to this free exchange of ideas and opinions in society. And so we're going to go for a place where we're trying to bring a lot of ideas and opinions to the marketplace so that people can draw from those and develop their own critical responses to those topics.
Beth, what about you? You're selling books in downtown La Crosse. A lot of your inventory is used books and some new books as well. How much do you get to pick and choose what goes into your collection, and how much are you relying on people to just bring it in and say, hey, do you want this?
I definitely get to choose what's in. As an independent bookstore, I get to choose and select what I want in the bookstore. And if we don't have the used copies of banned books, we absolutely carry them new, because I think it's incredibly important that these books are available for people to read, because sometimes the banned books, quite honestly, are the best books.
I've seen on social media the memes that people share back and forth proclaiming that that they read banned books, like, intentionally. So you're saying also that you stock them intentionally. Why do you think that is an important effort on your part?
Well, I think banning books undermines one of the primary purposes of democracy and of education, and I believe in lifelong learning. And reading a banned book, it helps us kind of think for ourselves, you know, that develop those critical skills, thinking like, is this true? Is this what I believe? Does this align to my values? Or can it teach me something new? Can it offer me a different perspective? Parents who want to ban a book, I often say to them, you know, why don't you read it with your child instead and think of the conversation you can have and this opportunity to impart your values back to your child of why you're upset about this book or why this book doesn't align with your values. I see, you know, whichever perspective you're coming to the banned book from is a really great opportunity for conversation, learning, and growth.
How do you define what constitutes a banned book? What constitutes just a book that's maybe unpopular or something like that?
Well, yeah, a banned book increasingly is where an agency of the government, whether it be a public library or another institution, it basically removes that content from the marketplace. And we see this happening a lot in public libraries. So if you look at the American Library Association statistics, I mean, this is just overwhelming. We're seeing the largest number of attempts to ban books than they've been measuring for over 20 years. And the bulk of those, 48%, are happening in public libraries, which are government institutions, right? These are publicly funded government institutions, and people are basically saying, well, we are calling for that public library to remove something so that people do not have access to that particular book in this public facility, in this public institution.
Where do you think that comes from, Sam? That, like, when I walk through the library or when I go through a bookstore, I know I've been in Beth's store a number of times. If I see something that I don't want, I don't check it out and I don't buy it. And to me, it's that simple. Why do other people, some people feel the need to see something that they find distasteful in one way or another, and they want to remove that from anyone's ability to possess?
You know, I asked a similar question yesterday. I do a podcast at Fulcrum, and I asked James LaRue. Now, Jamie used to be the head of the Freedom to Read Foundation for the American Library Association, as well as the head of their Office for Intellectual Freedom. He was basically the person in charge of Banned Books Week and gathering all of this stuff for the ALA. He's just done a new book called On Censorship, A Public Librarian Examines Cancel Culture in the United States. And he posed four reasons that he thinks this is really happening today, just real briefly. One is personal prejudice, that people want to stop things that maybe they experienced in their lives. Two is parental panic, and we've seen waves of that over the years. Three is demographic panic, the fear that maybe society is changing in ways that you can't control. And the third, which he really felt was the new one and the one where people are attempting to, in essence, repurpose the whole purpose of a public library, is using the apparatus of the state to declare certain topics basically off limit to change the conversation. And so we're obviously in a divisive political environment right now, and people are basically, you know, looking at this as an opportunity to say, well, I disagree with that. And so therefore, instead of trying to be civil and disagreeing with that, I'm instead just going to try and close off that whole avenue of conversation, because I don't like to hear about it, and I don't think people should hear about it, and so therefore we should just not hear about it at all.
Well, Sam, you and Beth are here to talk about a very interesting event coming up on Saturday at Pearl Street Books, which is sort of a public celebration, really, of banned books. Beth, tell me what's going to be going on at the store on Saturday.
Yeah, on Saturday, we're going to have an open mic for banned books. So you can come in with your favorite banned book or just borrow one of ours and have an opportunity to read a passage of it over at a mic so that the people that are in the store can listen to part of it and just kind of bring about awareness about how great these books are and how important they are and a chance to celebrate them. So from noon to five on Saturday at Pearl Street Books.
If somebody doesn't know how to find, you can just Google banned books, but if somebody just hasn't consciously said, I'm going to read banned books and doesn't know which ones to choose from, how do they start making that choice if they want to participate?
We actually mark them at our store. We have little blue strips of paper by some of the banned books. Not all of them are marked, but many of the banned books in our store have a little mark. You know, so for example, Charlotte's Web is a book that has been banned in the past by a parent group in Kansas because it talks about death and talking animals. And so people are always surprised when they see that banned book slip by Charlotte's Web because it's a beloved book by most of us.
I've never heard that. That's really Charlotte's Web.
Correct.
Wow.
You know, when I was talking with Jamie yesterday, he made the great comment. He said, you know, odds are a book you've loved sometime in your life has been attempted to be banned at some point. It's wild when you look back over the history of banned books or attempts to ban books at some of those titles.
I mean, Fahrenheit 451 and Charlotte's Web on the same list. There we go. So I want to ask you both if you have a favorite or a couple of favorite banned books, either from through the years or from more recent years. Sam, let's give you a chance to go on that one first.
I've got a couple. One that I've actually worked with high school students with over the years is Of Mice and Men. That one tends to pop up in the top 10 list again and again, most recently in 2020 as books attempting to be banned. The Kite Runner, which is an absolutely beautiful story that just opens your mind and your heart to other people on another part of the world dealing with adversity, has been attempted to be banned many times over the years. A book that I saw firsthand really impacting students because it spoke to them in a way that other books didn't is Angie Thomas's The Hate U Give. Again, another book that regularly finds itself in that top 10 attempts to ban from the American Library Association.
Beth, what are some banned books that you want to bring attention to?
Yeah, one of my most recent favorites is by Julie Otsuka, a Japanese-American author who wrote the book When the Emperor Was Divine, and it was recently challenged and banned in Muskego, Norway, school district in Wisconsin. And this is about the Japanese-American internment of citizens during World War II. And it's just a wonderful story. And the teacher was trying to have it in the 10th grade advanced reading English class. Yeah, and it's a wonderful, wonderful story. And then I always go back to Toni Morrison's book, The Bluest Eye and Beloved are two of my favorite banned books. They're just fantastic works of literature.
The book that you mentioned about the internment, we see that trend a lot where people are objecting to books that are very intertwined with actual historical events. In cases like that, I don't want to speak for people who aren't here, but like how do you tell when somebody just is so offended by that part of history that they don't want people to talk about it, or is there something else about the book that the book that they find objectionable?
I think it's strictly about history, and they don't want the reality of history showcased in a classroom. And it's a very heartwarming, gut-wrenching story. So I think it definitely will raise empathy in students and as they're learning about this part of history. And I think that's very fearful.
Sam, you were talking earlier about the importance of free speech and people's rights to read what they like and experience a whole broad swath of literature. But when we're talking about people not accepting historical fact, we see many times it's because people were raised with sort of a different understanding. I lived in the South for a long time where this is absolutely mm-hmm. true. People were raised with an incorrect understanding of what history actually was, and when they're faced with that reality for the first time, they assume it's propaganda. So, and so, like when you talk about like free speech and freedom of the press, like these people engage their whole lives with incorrect material that was allowed to be perpetuated in part because you can really publish anything. How do people know whether what they're getting is actually factual? In an era where anybody can pretty much publish whatever they want,
you know, that is the $64,000 question of society today. So much of our free speech principles are rooted in 19th century thinking, writings by people like John Stuart Mill, and obviously this predated the internet. The internet obviously complicates things, but what I always ask people to do is to be a critical thinker. Look deeper and look at the credibility of the person who's writing it. Look at a wide breadth of information to take in. This is, again, why you want this so-called marketplace of ideas out there. To be a good critical thinker in a Republican democracy, which we are, right, to be a good citizen means sometimes to be challenged with your thinking. We have this idea today that if someone challenges our thinking, that's negative. Where if we get to the essence of it, being challenged is actually a good thing because it either affirms what we're thinking and forces us to back it up, or forces us to maybe look at things a little bit differently and realize that maybe we don't have the whole truth. This is all drawn right out of John Stuart Mill's On Liberty as to why we need this approach of free expression and free speech. And it is certainly more complicated when anybody can hold themselves out as an expert. I say in general that if you're publishing books, those are more likely than not, especially if it comes from a publishing company, to be more reputable, right? Because those are going to go through an editorial process, a fact-checking process, and a company is basically standing behind what is in that book. But more and more, if we have self-published materials, if we have content on the internet, it becomes hazier. So I encourage people all the time, be an omnivore, be willing, as Beth said, to open your heart and your mind to those other ideas, because you'll be tested, but that's a good thing. You'll be pushed, but that's a good thing for you to develop as a good citizen.
Sam, if people are interested in learning more about Fulcrum Publishing, particularly Jamie's book that's coming out, where can they find that?
Well, they can go to bookstores like Beth's. Beth has a wonderful display of Fulcrum's books, but you can also go to our website. It's Fulcrum Publishing. So it's www.fulcrumbooks.com and check out all of our titles. We do a lot of stuff on freedom of expression, on censorship and why that's not a good thing, and just generally about our civil society.
And Beth, if people want to come and read some banned books, either by themselves or out loud at Pearl Street Books on Saturday, what do they have to do?
Just show up at our door, 323 Pearl Street. We'll be open from 10 to 8 every day except for Sunday, but that day particularly, the mic will be open, will be on from noon to 5.
Okay. And do they have to like sign up, or do you think people just walk in and walk up to the mic and go?
They'll be able to sign up at the front desk. Okay. We'll have a little sign up sheet, but you don't have to sign up in advance. We don't anticipate there'll be huge lines. Well, maybe we'll be surprised and there will be huge lines, but that'll be a celebration.
It's not scary.
Correct.
Perfect. Beth Hartung is the owner of Pearl Street Books in La Crosse, and Sam Shinta is the publisher of Fulcrum Publishing. Thank you both very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ezra, so much.
This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. If you would like to let us know what you think about today's show or suggest a topic for another one, I'd love to hear from you. My email is newsmakers@wpr.org. That's newsmakers@wpr.org. There are multiple opportunities to hear the show every week. We're on Friday morning at 10 on the Ideas Network 90.3. We're on Friday night at 7 on NPR News and Music 88.9. And of course, we're always online at wpr.org/newsmakers or in your favorite podcasting app. Just search for WPR Newsmakers. Until next week, I'm Ezra Wall. Thanks a lot for listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio.